I want to introduce Chris, who's the founder of Loveless.org. And what Loveless does is it serves people through simple acts of service. And people who big organizations are not able to reach because of their sheer size and the inflexibility that comes with it. I've had several very interesting conversations with him and learned a lot about him during those. And I know that he himself is not afraid to go and serve where needed. I mean, I remember a story where there was an older couple who had a block of wood and they were too old to be able to chop it for firewood and their house was cold. So he himself went and actually helped them chop the wood. And, you know, the ripple effect, so it's so interesting that the neighbor who saw him doing this then took the responsibility to do it. So not only is this serving people, but also helping involve community in the service. And so it definitely is amplifying altruism is what the impression I came away with. Chris and his daughter Aubrey started this Labor of Love project. And even before this organization was started, Chris has been volunteering for several causes and has always been inspired to alleviate suffering of his fellow human beings. A couple of things that stand out for me about Chris are that how much his values match with service-based values. That was the first thing that struck me when he was talking. I mean, maybe he uses different terms, but it just the values just match. And also the whole egolessness. If you go to his website and try to find some information about him, you will not really find much because he just wants to keep it all anonymous and let the work speak for itself and not lengthy intros. And I will let Audrey and Vinya lead this conversation, but we'll leave you with this one thing that I really found very inspiring on their website. He says that we keep our contributors and ourselves anonymous to our clients. We ask nothing in return but for them to find and help three people in need and then ask those people to do the same. How wonderful. So I give it to Audrey and Vinya, and I think Audrey is going to start the conversation. So take it away, Audrey.
Yeah, thank you, Kanchan, and thank you, Chris, for joining us. It's funny, even as you were speaking like a few minutes ago, I felt like I could feel the warmth of you through your voice. So to kind of get us a bit started, I was wondering if you could just share a bit about what Loveless.org, a little bit more about what Loveless.org is and maybe what inspired you to start it.
Sure, I'd love to. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for having me. Basically, Loveless.org, our mission is to amplify altruism in others, and what that means in short is just... Everybody has the ability and I think even the want, the need to help other people. A lot of times they don't know how or they kind of get busy in their day-to-day lives and it's real easy to miss those opportunities or to stop even noticing them. And so we want, you know, our basic goal is to try and encourage and empower the people that already do so actively and to bring that awareness to the people that don't do it actively, that those opportunities are out there. They happen very often, and if they're not, you know, hopefully encourage people to look for them. This all started way back when, you know, growing up and going through young adulthood, I was exposed in early college to some volunteer work, the opportunity to do some volunteer work. And I remember kind of begrudging the kind of, it's a chore, I'm going to have to. It's not, you know, it was one of those things that needed done that was work, basically work to me. And I was immediately hooked through the program that I went through to the feeling of you know, having that be the, like where you go to a job and you're actively providing something for other people or just the feeling of the interaction. It was so much different than, you know, going to work or hanging out with friends or even just going on your own and doing nice things, you know, raking leaves for a neighbor or something. And so all my life I made it a mission to have a second job, if you will, of you know, some kind of community service or service to society, some civil service type work, whichever, you know, there's many things along the way. And for a long time, I had a very high risk, a second job that was very high risk law enforcement work. And I did it all pro bono. I did it all. I did it almost all unpaid. But the amount when I was paid, I always rolled back into basically gifting to some of the clients at the time. And I needed to step away from that as my kids got older because I didn't want them following in my footsteps of that high risk type volunteer work. So it motivated me to start looking at other replacements. And what that ended up rolling into was went through about a year of evaluating and kind of sampling volunteering for different organizations and researching different organizations to be involved with. And I really couldn't find my life is kind of complicated schedule-wise sometimes, and I couldn't. I'm a single father of three, et cetera, and so I wasn't really finding a good match for what I wanted out of my time and just matching it with life, work-life balance in my regular work schedule because I've always had a career job on the side or as my main job. And my daughter, who just turned 18, at the time she was 15, and we were discussing, you know, kind of the situation over the months that I was looking. And one of the days we were out jogging and she had mentioned I had mentioned to her, referred to a movie called Pay It Forward and how much, as an example of something I was trying to describe to her at the time. And she had mentioned she'd never seen it. And I was like, what? Okay, well, since we get home, let's throw it on, take a look at it. Because you need to see this movie. It's a great movie. And during watching it, she had, you know, basically I'd mentioned, you know, this is kind of, this encapsulates a lot of the things I'm looking for in volunteering and in doing, you know, the stuff on the side. And I wish I could find something that really captures all the pieces that I'm looking to get out of it, and I'm looking to provide both that interaction, something that matched it more like this. So it'd be awesome. And she kind of turned to me, and it was one of those epiphany moments where she said, well, you've started other businesses. Why don't you just do it? Why don't you make it? And I started giving her the normal excuses, you know, it's going to cost too much time, too much money. It's going to, you know, you have no idea what you're talking about, 15-year-old. You know, it's going to take way too much work, you know. And I've never, and on top of that, I've never run a nonprofit. It's very, very different than running a for-profit. I had no formal education in it, didn't know anybody that was doing it. You know, I'd spent all my time, either family time, working a main job, or volunteering. I didn't, you know, have this built-in network of nonprofits to tie into or anything. So, but I kind of stopped halfway through that explanation, and I realized I'm just feeding her a bunch of garbage, you know. I'm giving her the standard excuses, but they're all just excuses. They're empty. And I told her, you know, I stopped kind of mid-sentence, and I told her, you know, the truth is I don't know. These are a bunch of excuses, and I just haven't done it. It just seemed overwhelming, so I didn't do it. I never took it seriously in the fact of just creating it or in the idea of creating it. So I started literally before the movie finished. I got up, went over to the computer, started researching how to create a 501c3 and maintain it and the whole bit, and it's just been an ongoing experience from there. It's been awesome.
Wow.
And but that's literally the beginning. Is just started with a conversation. Started with an example, and rolled into creation of what I was looking for.
What wow. A beautiful story, and especially it takes so much of courage and strength to, you know, to just take the plunge and to start something. So can you tell us what inspires you? What inspired you when you were growing up to, you know, acts of generosity and altruism that you have experienced in your life that may have laid the foundation to do this beautiful work today?
Absolutely. It's very clear to me upon reflection, you know, the motivating factors there. It was, I was fortunate, I live here in Portland, Oregon, and I was fortunate enough to grow up in what would be considered the ghetto of the city over on 9th and Alberta. And it's an awesome neighborhood. It's great, filled with, you know, just the most diverse collection of cultures and races in the city. And it's just, it's amazing. And when I grew up there, it was a little rough. I mean, there was, you know, when I was in the corner store half a block away, I was allowed to walk there starting at about 5 years old and to school by myself, et cetera. And so I'd been in that store when it had been held up at gun and knife point multiple times, starting at around 5 years old. And I'd gotten mugged for my school books on the way home, all kinds of things, just, you know, a bike stolen out from under me, literally taken off of it and it taken away from me, a block from home, all this stuff. And so it was a very interesting experience, kind of growing up in that neighborhood. And growing up in that neighborhood, I'm Caucasian, and I grew up being the minority in that neighborhood, mm-hmm. which was the most... it was the most awesome thing ever, basically. It was just the difference in my own thinking and influences was fantastic. It gave me a very well-rounded experience. By the time I'd grown up to, you know, mid-teens, we moved to a not at all, you know, economically or racially diverse area. And so it was just a very surreal experience. And so... basically, when I was real young, when I was around, it was either 5 or 6, and I was on 9th in Alberta, and playing across the street in St. Paul's Cathedral, which is still there. I was in their yard, and we lived next to a Hmong family, a Laotian family, next door to us on the right that had, I think it was 8 children. And the children spoke English, but the adults did not. And it was a multi-generational family. I think there was 4 generations living in the same house, and they didn't know how to use the electricity or the water, or, you know, they'd they basically had escaped Laos during some political trouble, and not all of their family had made it. And so I got to be very, very good friends with those kids. Mm. And they were just an amazing, fantastic family. And I learned a lot socially from them. And they were very helpful in my social development. And I think I had just turned 6. It was just after my 6th birthday. I was over there playing soccer with one of the kids. He had just ran home for something. And the mother, she was maybe mid-50s, came walking, dressed in these brilliant, beautiful colors, and had a sarong and kind of a wrap around the baby that kind of held it very tightly to her body on the front, and her purse, and then some groceries. And she's walking kind of between the way the cathedral sat. It was blocked, this courtyard was blocked off from the street on both sides pretty well. And as she came walking towards me, these 2 women came out of different sides of the courtyard and ran towards her and just basically attacked her. One of them grabbed the baby, the other one grabbed the purse, and the purse was kind of around her neck on one side and hanging on the opposite side under her arm. So it wasn't easy to remove, you know, it was a big purse too. And they just basically were tugging and ripping at her from both sides and kicking her and punching her in the face and all these horrible things, you know. And I was just mortified. And I ran over and had picked up some rocks and were trying to throw them at these women's legs and trying to miss the mother, you know, so I had to get close, you know, and just thinking back on it, as this little 5 or 6 year old running over, it was doing nothing, you know. I don't even think I was hitting them. I was yelling and I was screaming at them to stop, and I was so afraid to run at them. And it wasn't even, what was most overwhelming to me wasn't the fear for myself, it was the fear that I was being so ineffective, you know. And so I turned around and I ran back across the street to my house and was screaming for my mother. And I remember she was so calm. She just raced over. She told me, stay in the house. Don't come out here. Stay here. And she locked the door from the inside, shut it, and just bolted across the street, and I could see her running across the street through the big window, and I was just so, I can't even describe the mix of emotions, but I can just feel it every time I think about it so strongly. Mm. And, you know, she disappeared from view. I finally got out of the house, and my intention was to go help her because I didn't know what to do. There was no, you know, I don't know if 911 even existed then. I don't think so, but I finally got out of the house and got about halfway across the street, and she came walking back with the mother holding the baby, and she still had her purse attached, and she was just, it was just the most amazing thing, because what I thought, that moment of them coming towards me was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And I mean, I'm including my children's births, et cetera. It's just that, you know, there's so many beautiful things in the world. But that moment was so impactful in a way that was so different, because the mother's head was rested on my mother's shoulder. My mother was kind of cradling her and the baby in the most protective, like, lioness way, you know, and kind of escorting her back over to our house. And, of course, you know, there was they were just mortally afraid of the police, because the police where they had come from were a lot of the problem, were the ones killing people, et cetera, in the particular situation they were escaping to come here. And so she didn't speak any English. She refused the police involvement. She just wanted to be safe, and she didn't want to leave our house anymore, so she had stayed there for quite a while, actually, and her family was able to take her home. But it was such a nurturing moment that impacted me just the rest of my life. I mean, I've seen a lot of, you know, in the law enforcement stuff, I've seen a lot of really, really horrible stuff, you know, case files and interaction with people, but nothing touches that moment in my life. And seeing something so terrifying and so horrible turn into something so beautiful, you know, and so and having the right outcome. But it took the willingness of somebody to step out of their comfort zone to put, you know, to sacrifice something, or potentially sacrifice something, to make that happen. You know, and I'm not sure my love, you know, I'm not sure if she got away from the women before my mom got there, or the interaction there, what happened, but it was just the outcome that was so important. And the willingness to help to begin with. I mean, those two things tied together really just strongly impacted me to drive me towards trying to provide that for other people at every opportunity throughout my life.
Wow, Chris, I could just picturize the 6-year-old boy standing there and, you know, the mom and your mom. It was, and it's so many years ago, and just the fact that you still have it so vividly in your memory shows how much, how deeply it has impacted you. That's just...
Well, I get emotional every time I talk about it, I describe it. It's just extremely impactful. There's,
I can feel it. I can totally feel it. So it sounds like your mom has played a very, very big part in defining your values. As you were growing up, were there other influences and other people? I know it wasn't as deep as what you just shared, but were there other examples of generosity and altruism that inspired you?
Many. I wish I had time to describe them all. Many. I was very fortunate to have, you know, I was growing up kind of in the poorest of areas for the area and of circumstances, which it's subjective, right? I mean, it's just your experience compared to what you think, what you see in others, and what you think. You know, but I was oblivious to all of that until I would go visit my father down in down south a little bit more, and he was more well-to-do. We had a lot of more things available to us, and he's a very, very intelligent man, but less emotionally connected, more distant, but extremely loving at the same time. It's kind of hard to maybe describe clearly, but what's important there is it was very kind of surreal to me to go from one style of living to the other. It was so drastic, the differences were so drastic. And I was very fortunate in the fact I got a view of kind of altruistic acts from my father's perspective, of, you know, providing some money or providing, you know, help, and then going back to my mother's and then seeing her version of, you know, I can never think of a time where we weren't, you know, helping people one way or the other, and receiving help as well, you know, it was a very community type of feel living there. And it wasn't as much at my father's. It was a little more removed, but the willingness and the style was there. And so I have to say my parents were very influential. As I got into, I didn't really see it from other people until I got into college. Well, my senior year of high school, my freshman year of college, and kind of looking backward, being involved with these programs, different programs. Women's Link to Recovery was my first internship down in Jackson County, Oregon. And they provide a lot of services for runaway, counseling, et cetera, and services for runaway teens and women that are incarcerated, et cetera. And looking back at that point in my life, I could see so clearly so many interactions with people. I had a vice principal at a junior high school that made a huge impact on my life. I've always been I was reading by the age of two. I only slept 2 to 4 hours a night for many, many years, about 26 years of my life. I had severe insomnia, and so I did a lot of reading growing up. I did a lot of things that made me, it was almost like living two lifetimes in a single lifetime span. So by the time I got to middle school age, I was not very socially developed because those differences between me and other children at such a young age were very apparent, and then I did not socialize real well. I was kind of removed from the normal social development, and so I was behind by the time I hit junior high school. And so there was, some physical altercations and other things that were going on that were disruptive to other students and myself, And I had a junior high vice principal that pulled me aside and compared his testing scores from when he was younger to my own and gave me some real good analogies. Using himself as a baseline, and it really helped me see a lot of things clearer, that it was just a difference in understanding, not a difference in willingness to, participate or willingness to not disrupt things in class by, normal kid-like behavior pretty much. But it was that interaction with him that made a huge, huge difference to me. And it's such a simple thing. It was a conversation. He took his time to pull me in, and he was looked at as such a hard kind of stand to the side and just disciplined from afar type of individual to the student body. That was the general consensus. He was a very stern man. And yet he was really, he set pride aside, he set his time aside, and he, it wasn't just that he did his job. He did it so well by allowing himself to be the example, not just for good things, but for bad things too, and then offering some solutions as to how he was able to turn things around a little bit, and everything he said was right. Trying the things he said, because that's pretty stubborn and headstrong back then. Trying the things that he had mentioned, it was such a light conversation. Now that I look back on it, but to me, it made all the difference in the world. It really changed my perspective in a lot of ways that let me be a lot more productive, a lot more accepted, a lot more functional in the things that I wanted to do. It was just a huge change in my life. So I think he's a good example.
Thank you. So from all those beautiful stories from when you were a child, I'm curious to know about some of the more recent stories with Lovelist. And I was looking at your website about some of your past cases, like helping a homeless mother and daughter find housing mm-hmm. or a wheelchair for disabled youth. And I was wondering if there are any people or particular stories from your experience or recent experiences that stick out to you.
Yes, many. I think the one that was, well, there's two really. I guess I'll kind of explain them a little shorter. Two of the ones within our first year really stuck out to me. I tried to create a very broad-ranging mission statement for a reason. A lot of big charities, well, a lot of just charities in general, are limited by their funding or by their charter. Because they have to agree to such a narrow band of what they can do to receive funding. It's a lot of times the way it works. So out of all the charities, they seem to have, many of us seem to be limited in one way or the other. And so I made it very broad-reaching for a reason. I wanted to save the cost of vetting by only accepting cases, potential cases, from other organizations that have already done the vetting. So we only receive cases from fire departments and police departments and other charities that are not able to find a resource to help people in whatever situation they're in. It doesn't matter. I don't want to worry about judging the situations too much. That's what my board of directors is for. But I only want to be able to accept ones that have already looked for resources. They've had some service or professional entity try and find resources for them, and they haven't been able to, because that kind of makes us the last bastion of hope. You know, it allows us to kind of try and be a filter, the last line of defense sort of, of a filter through cases that are already slipping between or have already slipped through the cracks, so to speak. And the issue I looked at there is, you know, I kind of had a choice. Do we want to be as broad-reaching as that? And then because of that, be limited in logistical ability and scalability, but we have basically infinite extensibility. You know, did I want to do that, or did I want to be more limited and targeted and maybe more effective by narrowing our focus? And I decided with the broad reach, because that's kind of what I was looking for, you know, to achieve, is not to necessarily judge what we were helping, but to provide, if we could, whatever was being asked for, because that would allow us to basically be infinitely broaden our reach as far as what we could do, potentially, you know, if we could find the resources or the ability. So that's what we went with, and in doing so, two of our most often worked with entities, it ended up being two specific charities, My Father's House, which is the, I believe, the nation's largest privately funded homeless family shelter. They help about 112, I believe it is, families at a time here in the Northwest transition from homelessness, basically, to being self-supportive. And the second charity is the transitional, Community Transitional School, which is a organs-only homeless children's school. And these people, they're amazing. They will go pick up and drop off kids every single day, even, you know, homeless kids, even in different places across the city, wherever their parents happen to be at, if it's a different place than they started in the beginning of the day, et cetera. And their whole goal is just to provide schooling for these homeless kids and to be able to also mix into their normal curriculum, you know, the importance and the ability to maintain and increase self-esteem, dignity, you know, service to others, et cetera. And so these organizations, those two organizations, we've received many cases from over the past several years. And in that first year, there was one that came from the homeless family shelter that was, it was just a very wrenching story. You know, it was around the holidays. Our first year is actually, it was either our first or second case. I believe it was our first case. And it ended up where a woman and her two teenage and one very young son had been married 13 years, had a husband had kind of left and emptied their bank accounts out of the blue, and that's when she found out that rent hadn't been paid for several months, that the bills hadn't been being covered, and so she was already in debt. She had only been working part-time, so she increased, she was able to increase her employment to full-time, which was, you know, very, very lucky in itself, but even working full-time, she was not able to cover the back amount of bills that had been left. And, you know, the amount is kind of subjective, right, as opposed to, you know, the impact of how much it would mean to anyone, it depends on their earning power and what they're kind of doing, you know. For her, it would have taken her, if she was able to put money aside, which she was a little bit, if they hadn't existed, it would have taken her about 2 years to save up the amount that was needed to cover that case. And so this was really bright and early when we had no funds at all. And, I mean, we've never operated with a large budget. We get a couple $1,000 in donations per year. But it's this, we had maybe $50 sitting in the bank account, I think. And we needed, I think it was $650 to cover that case. And which to some people, not a lot of money. To others, it's everything. You know, to this woman, it was 2 years of her life doing nothing else, just saving. And the interest alone, it wouldn't have covered. You know, I mean, it was just, she was already underwater. So we found these cases out through the charities, through their case managers and other people. We don't actually have interaction usually with the people directly, with our clients. It's indirectly through project managers, program managers that we work with, that they're aware of the needs directly. They've already vetted them. They've already tried to find other resources. I had one of these individuals, an awesome guy, let me know about the situation. The board said, yes, let's try and help her. And so we literally, my other board members were really busy at the time, so the kids and I, my daughter Aubrey, ended up going to recruit a couple of her friends to go around with her from high school, and I took my oldest son out, and for several weekends we went kind of canvassing the neighborhood just asking for donations for this case. We just went door to door, and it was the fastest way to generate it from outside of personal. And we ended up coming up with the money. And when we made the delivery, we usually meet. We don't always meet with the person, depending on what it is we're trying to accomplish. But in this case, we met with her. And when we do, it's usually two of us from the organization. Or even one person from the organization and somebody else. I can kind of go over that later. But we met with her for about just 5 minutes, and we just told her, hey, we found out about your situation. We are from your community, and we love you. We can see how hard you're working and doing everything you can, and we respect that. And we just wanted to give you a hand because you need it. And she was, I remember, she was so, the look of concern when we met, actually, because she was just so terrified of everything in life at that point. She was so, mentally, she had been broken down. She was just at her wit's end, didn't know what to do. She had been, reached out to different places for some resources, and it just, there's a lot of red tape where she wasn't able to meet their criteria, or all these things had fallen into place where she was able to find shelter. We were not able to keep her in her house. There was just too much kind of back owed, and the landlord had already been kind of fed up with the situation with her husband, and so that was not possible. But she was staying at my father's house at that point. She transitioned into there. The settling was great. But she was just so, even through that, where she had a place to stay, she was working full-time, her kids were happy and healthy, she was just so concerned and felt so much like a failure, with this looming thing over her that she couldn't get out from under of and had no plan to be able to, and yet no resources to alleviate it either. She was, I think, worried that maybe we were there not for what we said we were, that maybe it was something to take her kids or to whatever. She was just terrified of everything. And I remember the transition of receiving that money. I mean, we basically had paid it off through third parties for her, but letting her know that was covered was just such a relief to her. You could just see the emotions wash over and over on her face, mm-hmm. And that is not, that's sometimes the response, and it always feels great to see that. But the real point to me, what I was really seeing, was the effect that we'd had on her life that was going to kind of restore some faith or hope that she had lost previously. And that, in turn, would make her more willing to help others. It just naturally works that way. There's been a lot of research done over the years, and that case, just seeing her go through that transition so immediately, so right in front of us, was really, really cool for me. I mean, I got a lot more out of it, to be honest with you, than she did, or maybe even her children did. It just, the impact that has on my life is very, it's a very selfish thing, but it's true. The more I do it, the more addicting it is, and the more I'm fulfilled and I'm happy. I have a lot of PTSD type of things, or whatever you want to call it, from law enforcement stuff and a few things that happened in life, and nothing, from witnessing this stuff, nothing makes a dent against PTSD or depression issues or you name it. That level of negativity in the world, in my opinion, nothing alleviates it better than giving, than doing these type of things for other people. I think the residual effects from that level of positivity in your life, even without any interaction back, if you never meet the people that you help, just the ability to know the effect you have on their life, and maybe not even one person, maybe out of five, maybe out of 10, you just, you start to develop, and it kind of combats the normal evening negative news, you know, where you turn on the news channel and it's all negativity and all these bad stories locally or whatever is going on. And there's like one good story for every 20 horrific ones. And it just, I don't know, I've never found anything that really combated that sense of negativity and view of the world better than service to others. The other story, real briefly, was that impacted me at that level was a from the Community Transitional School. We were notified of I think the original case, the way it came through, was we were contacted by the secretary of the school who had said that, and we'd already had a previous relationship set up with the school, but I think this is our first case from them, that basically just said that they'd had a 12-year-old girl who was a straight-A student for, like, they'd had her for much longer than the average. I think their average is, I don't want to speak to their average because I'm going to misquote it, but it's not real, real long. It's like 6 months or a couple years. It was something shorter. This girl had been going there for 6 years, and which meant, in general, she fit the criteria of homelessness for them for, you know, the majority of that 6 years. And she'd been a straight-A student across all that time and had started missing more school, started seeming more kind of depressed. And through interaction, speaking with the mother, they were aware that there was some kind of issue with at home going on, and at home being the different places that they were staying. You know, since they were homeless, they had had some, you know, a family network basically to stay with, was the school's impression. And they just weren't sure of the situation, but they knew some kind of help needed done. They just didn't know what. So we set up a meeting. This is one of those cases where we did actually meet with the client. I met with the mother because we needed to find out really, you know, what was going on and if there was something that could be done from our end in that case. And what ended up happening, I met with the woman, and, oh, she was very nervous and very, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we try and limit the contact is a lot of times with what we do, it's kind of out of the blue. And even though we're having a meeting set up through whatever contact those people have to make them more comfortable and to kind of give us an introduction. So whoever they normally work with in their course of life, if we ever meet the client, we have them there, the intermediary person there. And so in this case, it was the principal of the school and the secretary. However, you know, this woman was extremely nervous and worried about, you know, here's some outside organization coming in. And I think that ultimately ends up working to our benefit because it unfortunately increases a little more apprehension and fear if the people know about the meeting ahead of time. But at the same time, it's such a good positive end to it that I think it ends up having a bigger impact. So I've never tried to change that format. Although, you know, there's a piece of it there that I don't necessarily like. But the ultimate effect is really the goal. So, and in meeting her and speaking with her, we found out that she'd had a drug conviction. Her husband had been dealing, and I don't know, maybe she was too, I have no idea, but what ended up happening was they were both incarcerated for dealing, and the child was stuck with family, and the woman got out after a year, the mother, and she ended up staying at the YMCA at first, and the father was, you know, she divorced the father, and he was in for long term. And while she was at the YMCA, she found a couple opportunities for employment and then lost them. She has COPA real bad, a respiratory condition, a degenerative respiratory condition. And she's kind of an older mother as well. And so with her health issues, she was kind of bouncing between disability and nothing and part-time work. And it was kind of oscillating. And it was really sad because she ended up, she stayed at the YMCA on the in this like kind of sixth ward for women and children to stay on, and they were there for about a year, and then the YMCA lost funding for that program, and so all the women from that ward had to leave, had to find other places to live. So they spent time in a car and living out of a car, and they spent time, you know, just basically completely homeless, and then they started oscillating between that and a family member. The downside was, she said, the family member that they were staying with, it was like a 500 square foot area that had, seven people living in it, and one of them was a newborn, and both parents were drug users. The brother was a drug dealer, and so she wasn't supposed to be around that. So her choice was, okay, I'm a parolee that has to be around this stuff to keep my daughter and I sheltered, or we live in a car, you know. It was not a good set of options. And that was kind of from her perspective, and she tried to reach out to other organizations and just hadn't had any luck. And so at the point we had met her and talked to her, she had received a year's worth of rent to be paid, up to $900 a month, from a local charity. But she had to find that place to live within 3 months. So she had been what she'd been doing was begging on street corners while her daughter was in school. Well, the daughter didn't know this, but she was begging on street corners to get up enough money for gas or bus fare to go to these different apartment complexes and et cetera and apply. But even though she would ask them all to waive the application fee, none of them would. So it was $25 to $40 a pop, and she would fully explain the situation ahead of time, and the managers would always say, oh, no problem, sure, we'll work with you. Oh, yeah, I can totally understand that. We help people like that all the time, blah, blah, blah. And then it would get denied, and the managers would say, oh, well, sorry, better luck, you know, and I can't refund money for the application fee, but, you know, thanks for trying, I'm really sorry, so okay, have a nice day. You know, and she was just overwhelmed at this point. This had been going on for 2 months, where she'd been begging for the money for the application fees, and then losing the application fee, even though she was being completely straightforward with her history. So, and the applications weren't being filled out 100%, I'm sure, because she was also illiterate, and so she basically memorized the fields of what first name, last name, et cetera, looked like, but if it differed at all from what she was used to, if she couldn't piece it together, she just had no idea what was expected in those fields on the form because she had just, you know, memorized how to fill out certain parts. And she was too embarrassed to let even her daughter know the level, you know, the extent of her her literacy problem. And so we kind of covered all these things real briefly, and then I bounced it off the board and I said, well, yeah, let's try and help her and do what we can. And so we spent basically 3 weeks. This one was actually very easy in what we had to supply. The difficulty was just in the logistics of managing the time. We spent about 3 weeks making phone calls to, I swear, all the apartment complexes in Portland. It was easily, I don't know, 50, 55 of them. And it was a matter of, in the end, we found one. And what it took was not only dealing with the apartment manager and the lawyer of the owner of the complex owned 5 or 6 complexes in the area, but the reality was she was a high risk. So we had to commit to meet with her once a month personally as an organization just to kind of touch base, see how everything was going, and make sure everything's okay, and have a liaison interaction between her and the apartment complex manager, who was awesome, by the way. She was just a doll. She was so great. And it was really that woman that helped push this through. And we met with them to help fill out the application, to make the introduction. So, I mean, we basically showed up every time this woman, the mother, met the apartment complex manager. We were there at the same time to help fill out paperwork, to answer any questions, to kind of provide moral support, because she was real nervous, real, you know, there was just a real fear of any interaction at all, of being judged, of being, you know, she'd just been through so much. She was completely overwhelmed, and understandably so. And, you know, through those interactions, we'd found out that we could just, you know, we kind of had some pushback from whatever level was above the office manager. And so we went to the lawyer of the organization, and I made some commitments to him. We got references from her parole officer, from the woman that was the supervisor of her ward over at the YWCA. We got, you know, just recommendations from everybody, past employers, et cetera, and sent them to the apartment complex's lawyer, and it finally convinced them to let them in. And through our interaction, touching base, they were able to move in the week of the little girl's birthday, which was just amazing, you know. And we were able to kind of cover, you know, they didn't have any furniture or anything else. And so, I mean, we have some, you know, ties with a community warehouse, et cetera, that provides furniture for people at a very low cost or for free and stuff. So we got her, you know, we furnished the place and all kinds of stuff. And so they literally got to go from just this horrible situation to a year's worth completely free so they could focus on sustainability, on becoming self-supportive again, as opposed to the little things that just knock you down every single month, you know. And I found out through our regular touch base, our monthly touch base, that I'd go over there and see how they're doing and see if they need anything, you know. And that's where the Community Transitional School is so amazing. They provide kids with, you know, not just the education, but also they get a lot of donations materials for really nice clothing, for school supplies, you name it. And so between the support system she already kind of had set up, she really just needed that one little step to get over the hump, you know, to get just past the current obstacle, and she was fine. You know, she ended up, they were there for that year. They were such great tenants. They got an extension from the apartment manager. They automatically, you know, extended her. And it was actually a six-month to begin with as well. When we first signed on, there were still, after all those recommendations, there were still, and our committed interaction monthly, they were still so afraid that she was going to, you know, start up. She had a history of meth use as well as the charges. You know, her charges were on use. Her husband's or ex-husband's were on dealing. And so with that meth use habit, you could tell she'd had a hard life. She had, her body was definitely abused by drugs over the years. And so, you know, they're real fearful that she was going to get into that old habit because it's just almost impossible. You know, I mean, the reality is anybody can do it, but it's when you go by just the statistics, it's almost impossible to do it. So apparently, you know, from the statistical side, and so that's what the apartment managers usually tend toward, obviously. So it's an awesome story because I know the backstory. Most of the cases we deal with, we don't get to know the backstory.
Yeah.
But in this one, we got to find out how it was extended. So that's why it sticks with me. It's just amazing, you know.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. That was, you walked us through. We actually wanted to ask you to tell us about, you know, how it actually works, and you beautifully walked us through it. One thing that we wanted to know was how has, you know, meeting with all these beautiful people and engaging in these beautiful acts of service of giving and also receiving so much, how has it changed your day-to-day life, and how does it influence your, you know, day-to-day life, maybe living a simple life or living without money, whatever values it is helping you hold. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I was, and thank you. That's a great question and one that I like to share pieces of that with. So I appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Sure.
The act of starting this was really, really scary to me. And I'm not worried about fear. I like to use, I mean, my personality, I very often have used fear as a motivator in my past. I'm not afraid to embrace change in my life or to tackle something just because it's scary or difficult. You know, I like, once I recognize that, which is sometimes the hardest part, I like to tackle those and change them, give them the opportunity to be something different or better. And this was definitely one of those things because while I'd had some business management experience, for-profit business management experience in the past, I had not had any experience running a nonprofit. And so the idea in the beginning, that part wasn't so daunting to me because I figured, well, I'll just find somebody to run it, somebody to do it, even if I have to pay them or whatever, you know, we'll just, that'll work out. And it'll be run just perfectly because I'll have somebody that's, you know, educated and versed in doing that. And when I really kind of delved into the research of it, I found out that is not going to happen. You know, I don't make enough money. I don't come from enough means to be able to, or earn enough means to be able to cover that. So what I did was I hired for 9 months somebody to kind of help out with that had just a fabulous resume for doing this. And I found, I interviewed more than 50 local charities, met with them, had lunch, et cetera, and kind of going over just, you know, the basic research of what it was I was getting into, their biggest hurdles, their biggest successes, et cetera. And when I looked at how I was going to apply all that, I realized I didn't have enough money. So I looked around real briefly to try and see if there was money available out there. But the thing is, part of what drove me to start this was our economy currently. Not just the, you know, I could volunteer a lot of places that do pieces of this. Since starting it up, I found other organizations that actually literally do what we do in some form. The thing is, it was, you know, there wasn't enough. Right, when I was looking around, there just obviously wasn't enough. Charities were folding because of lack of funding, et cetera. And so, but and yet, there's no time, no better time to start one. There's no time in our history, even during the Depression, there was many aspects of what's going on right now, here locally at least, that are worse. And some pieces are better, but some of the parts that I care very deeply about, it's worse. And so I really wanted, I saw the need now, regardless of, you know, what I could afford or the people that I could get involved. So the only other option open to me was a decision where I was opening a for-profit business at the time as well. I just started kind of getting into it, and I was a little further along that path than with the nonprofit. So I realized I was only going to be able to take on one. There's no way I was going to be able to manage two. And yet, if I picked the nonprofit, I was not going to be able to earn an income. I was going to have to survive off of my savings, which wasn't a lot. I mean, I guess that's subjective. But the reality is I had about $48,000 to my name between my 401k and my savings. You know, to some people it's a ton, to some people it's nothing, but that's what I had. So I was about a net $48,000. The ability to start this, I was going to have to survive off of about $20,000, you know, for my own living unless I limited it. And then it was going to take me what I estimated for how I wanted to start and what I wanted to do. It was going to take probably in the 501c, you know, all the filing fees, et cetera, that go along with creation of this. It was going to take roughly somewhere between $12,000 and $20,000. I wasn't sure how much at that point when I had to make this decision. So when I fully decided to do it, I realized I was only going to do one. So I picked the nonprofit. I had that discussion with you know, my ex-wife, who has the children the other half of the time, and with my fiance, and with my children, and you know, my mother, my brother, you know, all the people that would be potentially affected, because I'm the firstborn in the family. I'm generally, I'd like to say, a pretty responsible individual, and so I was going to be limiting myself if I took this on from being that person in their lives that's able to financially cover, you know, something that may happen. And so it wasn't a light decision. But the thing I always buck up against is my survivability wasn't at stake. I have full confidence and have demonstrated over and over my ability to, you know, jump back into earning power and to be able to get things accomplished. So I wasn't really worried about that. And I was happy to find out, neither was anybody else. You know, from knowing me all the years and growing up with me, et cetera, you know, my family, my friends, et cetera, they weren't worried about the impact. They were totally fine with it and extremely supportive and encouraging. I could have never done it without them. And so that made all the difference in the world. What ended up happening was I figured out how to live on a lot less. Over the course of 3.5 years, I only ended up spending, I think, about $8,000 in survivability money, and I just got wiped everything else out of my life. I became a minimalist, which goes back to those roots of not having a lot while growing up. I wasn't afraid of that at all. I wasn't worried about the comfortability because I know what makes me happy. I know what my true happiness is, you know, triggers are, and they're very minimal. They're very light. It's easy to, you know, I've never had a time in my life, more so than right now, that I've ever gone to bed happier or woken up happier every day. So having those needs met, it made this everything else just easy. Very easy. I got myself, personally, it impacted me by, I got down, by the time everything was said and done, the charity's easy to kind of manage at our current level of cases. We've helped over 100 cases at this point. We kind of average between at this point 1 and 5 per month that come through of leveling degree, or of differing degree. And, you know, I ended up, the only pain part for me was I'd miscalculated the point at which I was going to be successful for maintenance of the charity in its current form and going back to work. My mother ended up having some health issues, and so I ended up having to try and find work a little earlier, and it took a little longer than I thought it was actually going to, and so that part I missed. I ended up getting down to a net worth of $4.23. That's what I had in my checking account. No 401k, no savings, no other assets. It's just, you know, that's what I got down to. So that was a real humbling experience and an eye-opening experience because I didn't intend on getting quite that close. But the reality is, you know, since then I've found gainful employment, and I'm certainly self-sustaining, and as luck would have it, it all timed out great. My mom ended up getting better and everything got covered. But I'm so used to living on less now that I almost prefer it. I like it. You know, there's a couple of convenience things that I've put back into my life, but I'm living nowhere near what I was before. And the experience has definitely reawakened that appreciation of the things around me for what they are. And I'm talking about, like, the tools, you know, just cars and, you know, just the transportation and other things. You know, you get a certain awareness through your connection and dealing with these cases of what it really is, you know, when you really have you know, a right to complain about something, or you know what I mean? I mean, not really a right, but most people, I think, comparatively, you know, they relate to what they see and experience through other people sometimes, and in the constant interaction, you really it recenters you to what's most important at a daily, at just a constant basis for putting other people's needs before your own. And where I've spent a very drastic amount of time doing that in my life, it's never been like this. You know, through law enforcement, et cetera, I've been in some pretty just heartbreaking type of things. And that, you know, kind of speaks to the second part of your question is this, I've never run into anything in my life that alleviates the negativity like being involved at this level of literally not worrying about the overhead. We don't have any overhead to the charity. I cover all of that. So the charity itself has no overhead, no printing costs, no any of that garbage. We just literally throughput 100% of the money to the cases, the people involved that need it. Because I loathe the idea of building a charity that has, which makes it not scalable, but at the same time, I'm okay with that. You know, I don't like the idea of drawing a salary. I mean, I'd love to do it full-time also, but my time is my volunteer time. It's my time, my choice. I don't want to, it would lessen it for me to be paid for doing it. You know, I don't believe in that. I think that when people pay the money, I want it, I feel better. I feel like it's more of a right fit if 100% of it goes to the people that need it or to the people that will have their altruism amplified by it.
Hey, Chris, just to clarify, is this project a full-time thing for you, or is it still kind of like another second job?
It varies. It's been full-time up to 90 hours a week when I was putting it together and first handling cases for, I'd say, the first almost 2 years. Because I was handling cases personally before this was really formalized into a 501c3 entity. Now that it is, I have, it varies. I mean, I have, now that I've gone, I went to salaried work starting back in November. And at that point, I was putting in about 80 hours a week doing the charity stuff. I've cut that back to, I'd say if I had to average it out, I'd say I probably, the least amount of time I spend in a week doing charity stuff is about 30 hours. I'd say it has averaged over the last 4 months somewhere between 30 and 50 hours a week. But again, I sleep a lot more. I actually went through when I was 26, I was in a coma for 6 months. And that changed my physiology, the way my memory works, my body structure, everything, pretty drastically. One of the things that changed is instead of just requiring 2 to 4 hours of sleep every night, it's now kind of like more towards 4 to 6. So that's one of the really cool things because, you know, sleep is good for the brain. So it's that's a positive thing. The negative thing is I've had to, like, shuffle around what I do, but I'm still able to accomplish a lot more than average and still not sacrifice family time, for instance. And I include my family a lot with this. I mean, my daughter Aubrey is a student director on the board. She's been re-upped into that position and has been fairly active. And, you know, I take my sons and have them involved in certain aspects of not with the client interaction, of course, but with the, you know, gathering up of things and ideas and going through stuff, and they go with me to do a lot of things. So it's not really that hard to manage the time.
Hi, Chris. This is Nandini from Sunnyvale. Thank
Hi.
You so much for spending your Saturday. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And I am really inspired by almost everything you said, but especially two things. One, your relationship with money, and two, the fact that you're a parent and are being this role model of service for your children, which is not very common. I feel like once people become parents, they sort of are more focused on money and sustaining their families financially. So, and I think you touched on this a little bit in answering Vinaya's question earlier, but I'm just wondering, like, what do you do to not have this fear of not having enough? Like, what, I mean, do you engage in certain practices? Like, what's your process to kind of overcome the unpredictability of how much you will have to survive and live?
Well, I think that's a great question, and one that I'm a little bit embarrassed to answer truthfully, actually. The truth is, the real basic truth is, in growing up, I was lucky enough when I was very young. The school, even though I could read at a high level and speak at a very high level, et cetera, when I was in kindergarten or first grade, I'm not sure which, the school wasn't sure if I was mentally challenged because of my lack of proper social behavior. I think I'll just leave it at that. Or if I was highly functioning of some sort, like maybe autistic or something. You know, they just knew something was off than normal, and they weren't really prepared to deal with it at Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary is where I was going at the time, and the principal there. You know, everybody else on the staff was just awesome, but in my opinion, the principal did not deal well with the situation of what I was kind of bringing to his environment. So to avoid being just booted from the school, my mother had to get, be put in some counseling. And in this counseling, they had me tested at multiple things and decided that I shouldn't be in the grades that I was in. However, my mom wanted me to have the best opportunity of being socialized, so she left me in the grades and didn't let them advance me through the grades. They tried a couple of different times. But what this process identified for me is I have a – it's always used negative – these terms are always used very, very negatively in society. And even the information you Google and you find it online and stuff is very, very negative because of the lack of really good research and things done. But the reality is – there are some elements to my personality, very strong elements, that are literally psychopathic and sociopathic. And that's the truth. It's just the way I'm built. And the thing is, with all this good interaction and these people involved at such an influential point in my life very early on, it helped me identify that and really work towards some very basic level decisions that everybody has in their life. You know, you always have the ability and the choice to do good things or bad things, right, which in themselves are subjective. The terms are subjective. But in reality, we want to increase the pleasure of life and the enjoyment of life and the experience of life of those around us and ourselves. And or we can negatively impact that for our own gain for some reason. And it's a real basic choice every day, every interaction. And I was really, my mother was key in all that. I think if I hadn't had been raised in a single parent household with a mother for most of my life, not all my life, but most of it, if I didn't have if she wasn't the type of person she was, I mean, this is the type of I had some real impacts where I saw her sacrifice without complaint almost daily. She only wanted, me to have fun and the best things for me. But, I mean, when we didn't have enough money for Christmas presents, I remember the memories of being down the hall and being up the driveway, et cetera, late at night after she got off work and school, where she was using bandsaws and things. And I never knew what it was for, and it was to create me this little wooden elephant puzzle and to sew me a robe and a little stuffed rabbit and bear with the little baby bear and mama bear who they had snaps on their noses that kissed together. And, she made all these things for me for Christmas and for my birthdays because we didn't have money, And it's those things, the level of her sacrifice, and not just to me, but to everybody in the neighborhood. We had a silver thaw one year. Power lines are down. Everything is horrible. And there's just ice. Everybody's power's out for a couple of weeks. I don't remember how old I was. I must have been 6 or 7 here in Portland. And we had, I don't even know how many families. We lived in a 3-story house. It was a real rundown kind of thing. But, I mean, we had a lot of room in our house in a basement. And so we had multiple families that came over and stayed with us through that because we had a wood stove. And so we just cranked that thing and had it going 24 hours a day. People made meals on it in shifts. And we had the neighborhood basically living in our house, until people got power. And people would make food runs back over to their houses to bring over food to cook, for everybody. And it was just that level of interaction helped shape my perspective in a way that's why I always say I get a lot more out of it than other people. I'm extremely lucky to have those influences because I was either going to be one of the world's worst people or in jail or something, or I was going to turn out to be somebody who did stuff like I try and do, but I don't think there's going to be a lot of middle of the road. I'm a doer. I like to do things. I want to affect change and kind of make things different than they are. So that perspective was the most important in the world. I mean, I can't even I cannot emphasize enough the difference, because there's, I do not have, that's why I picked, for instance, law enforcement, the style that I did. It wasn't because I like to, let's say, hurt people or do bad things or have the ends justify the means in every case or any of the negative motivators that can be, but I do have the ability to not let fear get in my way. It is not even a factor. You know, my the only things that I have to train real carefully are my levels of judgment, what I'm judging and why, my motivators. But I'm not fed off adrenaline. I mean, I like it, but I'm not fed off it. I'm not fed off of, you know, the negative impacts on people, et cetera. But one of the feelings that I feel the strongest, I feel the strongest feelings in life from seeing somebody get what they deserve if they're a mean person or a bully, and that is a negative thing. That's a terrible thing. That's not something I want to feed in my personality, but it's true. I feed off that. You know, I'd rather, what's stronger to me, what I've built is stronger to me, is the influence of seeing somebody go through a system that turns them into a better person or has interactions turning them into a better person or enjoy things more in a positive way. And that's just from the law enforcement side. From the personal side, that's why I get so much more out of this than I ever did the law enforcement side, is you have all of those positive feedbacks of seeing people's lives improve or get better in a really awesome way, but mm-hmm. in a way where you sometimes hear the downstream, or if not even that, you know the net effect. If you've helped, let's say, 10 people, you know darn well several of those people have gone on to help other people, not even just the effect of themselves specifically. And that's really our motive. Our motive isn't necessarily to end homelessness with the charity. Our motive isn't to end homelessness. It's not to end, you know, the lack of education. It's not that, you know, if we can affect those things also, then that's just a perk. That's awesome, but it's a perk. Our real goal is to make a positive epidemic of people willing to help each other, of the pro-social behaviors, because that's what's most important. That's the positive pyramid scheme, right? It's the thing that's going to make the world a better place, as opposed to the immediate gratification negativity that we're fed, you know, from the TV, from the media, et cetera, which it's very normal for us to respond to as well. But being cognizant of that, you know, wanting to change that, that's the most important thing, to help people, to empower people to do that more and more for other people.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chris. Audrey?
We just really want to thank you for just sharing so honestly and so openly with us. And, you know, just from your experiences as a six-year-old, watching that mother and that woman, you know, get robbed, or, you know, just having all these little insights about how you're being selfish by wanting to give. And having, I can just picture, you know, picturing the whole neighborhood in your home with the wood stove. And there's really just a warmth to you and warmth to this call that has really, really touched my morning. So thank you so much for making the time on your Saturday morning to join us for this. And I believe Kanchan will finish the call.
Yeah. I also wanted to check, Chris, if there is something you think we can do to support your work as a community.
Sure.
We would love to know. Yeah.
There is. Thank you for asking. I have people ask me that a lot. It actually took me a little while to figure out, several months with interactions to figure out, because I was kind of, in the beginning, I was actually turning away some volunteers, like recommending them to other people, other organizations to volunteer, because we just weren't set up to manage that yet early on. And what I've come to realize is there's two things that I think are very important. To understand the concept, because it's actually a very complicated concept, but it's wrapped up in something that people can really relate to, I think, in some fashion, in the movie Pay It Forward. So if anybody on this call hasn't seen the movie, please, you know, what you can do is go out and watch that movie. I think everybody is pretty like-minded, which is the motivation to listen to the calls to begin with, but it really kind of encapsulates or lets you see the idea of just recognizing a need or something that somebody wants and making that your primary focus, if you can, you know, or a large focus in your life, the empathetic thinking. It really embodies that feeling very well visually. And it's a little canned, you know, as far as plot, et cetera, but the movie, I think it's a great delivery system for that realization or that relation for people. So if you haven't seen the movie, Pay It Forward, please see it. And the second part is, nobody needs an organization to do this. The reason why I started an organization to do this is to have an organization be an example of doing it and to handle the pieces that I wanted to accomplish that you kind of need an organization for. You know, people are more likely to donate or they're more likely to be involved if it's a 501c3 versus just Joe on the street corner saying he's collecting money for somebody else. You know, a lot of people would like some kind of format to an organization or to whatever's happening or the interaction and some auditing levels. So, but really, you don't need that. You know, I've been doing these kind of things all throughout the research and I will forever, you know, until I'm no longer here. All it takes is not what we ask people to do. It's kind of the same thing I apply to myself. It's not just helping the people that you normally would in your life. It's coming up with different ways or going and finding people to help that you normally would not. That's really the point. That's really the thing that changes our behavior and impacts others so strongly. You want to limit your to really get the altruism feeling, the gratitude feeling, as opposed to indebtedness. You know, if it's somebody you know, they're going to kind of have a feeling of indebtedness. But the gratitude comes from a lack of your motivation, you know, your willingness to help somebody else in a way where they perceive you're not getting much benefit or any benefit from it, so which is one of the reasons why we try and stay anonymous. You know, doing that, finding somebody outside your normal, not comfortability level, but somebody that's not normally, you're not normally interacting with, it's as far away as a hospital, a veteran's shelter, homeless people you see on the street, or any homeless shelter, anywhere you go. I mean, there's many opportunities out there. But I think the important part is picking something that's different. And it makes all the difference in the world. For instance, with my son, I came up with this year, he just turned 10 2 days ago, and his birthday gift this year, because it's something I hadn't done before, I gave him $100. But he only gets to keep 50 and apply, he has to apply half of it towards college, and the other half of that 50, he can do anything he wants with. He can buy toys, he can play video games, whatever he wants, totally up to him. But the other $50, he has to give away. And so he doesn't know it yet, but next Saturday, we're going to Pioneer Square, and he gets to pick whatever increments he wants to give it out, and he gets to pick anybody he wants to give it to. But he has to give away as much money as he gets to keep for himself. And I'm trying to help him prioritize at this age, because he's reasoning fairly well. I wanted to prioritize education, and I wanted him to prioritize giving. And I want him to give away as much as he keeps for himself. And his method of doing that, whatever his personality develops, that's up to him. But I consider it extremely important for everybody.
Thank you so much. And that kind of answers Nandini's question. Thank you so much, Chris, for this wonderful call.
Opportunity, Kanchan. I really appreciate it. Thank you.